Welcome to this podcast from the Commonwealth Club of California, a nonprofit, nonpartisan forum open to the public. I'm Gloria Duffy, President and CEO of the club. To learn more about events or membership, join us online at commonwealthclub.org.
Good evening, and welcome to tonight's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, the place where you're in the know. You can find us on the internet at commonwealthclub.org. I'm Jeff Farber, CEO of the Corrett Foundation, member of the Commonwealth Club Board of Directors, and your chair for tonight's program. Tonight's program is part of the Commonwealth Club's American Values series, underwritten by the Corrett Foundation and Tobey Family Foundations. Tonight's program will address the issue, is capitalism moral? It will be a debate about values, government, and the economy with two very distinguished speakers. From the financial crisis to Obamacare to budget debates, the size and scope of government is being debated across the country, including tonight. One side calls for more regulation to foster equitable prosperity because they believe the free market is out of control. The other side says government has grown too big, too intrusive, and we need to mitigate its power while rediscovering the founders' principles. Our distinguished speakers, Dr. Yaron Brook, President and Executive Director of the Ayn Rand Institute, and Dr. David Callahan, co-founder and senior fellow at the Public Policy Institute, Demos, will debate the fundamental social, economic, and moral ideas that underline politics in America today. Let me tell you a bit more about each of them. Dr. Yaron Brook of the Ayn Rand Institute is a former finance professor frequently interviewed in the media and co-authors a Forbes.com column. He has appeared on CNN, Fox Business Network, Fox News Channel, CNBC, and PBS, among others, and he lectures at college campuses and for corporations around the world. He holds a BS from the Technion Israel Institute of Technology and an MBA and PhD in finance from the University of Texas in Austin. He is the co-author of Free Market Revolution, How Ayn Rand's Ideas Can End Big Government. Dr. David Callahan of Demos is author of The Moral Center, A Look at Values in Politics and the Cheating Culture, Why More Americans Are Doing Wrong to Get Ahead. Dr. Callahan has appeared at colleges and universities around the country to discuss issues of ethics and academic integrity. He has also spoken to numerous business groups and professional associations and appeared on scores of television and radio programs to comment on high-profile scandals in sports, business, and academia. Dr. Callahan holds a BA degree from Hampshire College and a PhD in politics from Princeton University. Our speakers will be in discussion with the program moderator, Dr. Ruth Shapiro. Dr. Shapiro is principal of KE Strategies, a consulting firm specializing in business ventures between individuals and companies in Asia, Europe, and the United States. She is also social entrepreneur and resident at the Commonwealth Club and holds a PhD from Stanford University. And now to begin with some brief opening statements, it's my pleasure to present Dr. Yaron Brook and Dr. David Callahan.
Thank you. Good evening, everybody. I'd like to join in thanking the Commonwealth Club for hosting this event tonight, and in particular the Corrette Foundation and Tad Tobey for sponsoring it. So is capitalism moral? Yes. But more than that, I would argue it's the only moral political economic system. Now let me define some terms, because I think there's a lot of confusion about what capitalism is, and there's a lot of confusion about what morality is. So let's start with capitalism. When I talk about capitalism, as I understand the term, it means a completely private economy. It means a government that leaves the economy alone, that separates. There's a separation between state and economics. A government that does one thing and one thing only. Protect the individual rights of its citizens. Protects the right to life, liberty, property, and the pursuit of happiness. That's it. Nothing else. Now, what is the essence of individual rights? The essence of individual rights, and therefore the essence of what the government is supposed to do, is to defend us, protect us from coercion, from force, from violence. Protect us from crooks, thieves, fraudsters, arbitrary disputes. Protect us from foreign invasion and terrorists. And otherwise, leave us alone to pursue our happiness. So capitalism, I would argue, is a system of individual rights in which property is privately owned. It is the system that this country was founded upon. It is the system that protects the individual's right to his own life, his own liberty, and his pursuit, and the pursuit of his own happiness. Now, what does morality mean? That we could spend hours just talking about that. But in the context here, morality, I believe, is the set of values that individuals pursue in order to make their lives the best that it can be, in order to achieve their ultimate happiness, their ultimate, to use Aristotle's term, flourishing, human flourishing, individual human flourishing. So a system that allows individuals to make the choices to pursue the values that lead them to flourishing, that lead them to happiness, that lead them to success, that lead them to prosperity, is a moral system. A system that denies their ability to pursue their values in that direction, a direction of happiness, success, is an immoral system. What is the barrier? What is the barrier that stops people from being able to pursue their values, to pursue the things that they believe will lead to their happiness? It's coercion and force. Violence is the primary that stops us from being able to pursue our values, to pursue what we think will make our lives the best that they can be. So what we want is a government that extracts that coercion, that extracts force from society, that protects us from the use of coercion by other people. That is a capitalist government, and therefore that is why capitalism is a moral system. Any attempt by the government to coerce us into pursuing some other social agenda, coerce us into helping the poor or regulating businesses or any form of redistribution or any form of control, is immoral, because it introduces that immoral element, coercion, force, violence, into human relationships. That is the one thing that needs to be extracted. Now, I could talk a lot about the fact that capitalism works, and that's also part of why it's moral. It works, produces the good, raises the standard of living. We're all better off. The poor are better off. Everybody is better off. Everybody's willing to work. Everybody's willing to be productive. It's better off when we are free, when we are left alone. But to me, that argument is relatively common. It's prevalent out there. You can read Milton Friedman. You can read, you know, a lot of thinkers with regard to the economics of it. I think this perspective in terms of the role of government, this perspective in terms of morality and what morality means and what it means to pursue one's own values, I think is what makes Rand's approach, Ayn Rand's approach to the issue of capitalism unique and different, and underlies kind of everything else in terms of capitalism. And I hope you guys ask a lot of questions that relate to morality tonight rather than into the intricacies of economics, although I'd be happy to answer those as well. Thank you all.
Good to be back at the Commonwealth Club, and I also want to thank the club and Ruth Shapiro for taking on this topic. Morality and capitalism is one of my favorite topics, and I think it is a lot more interesting than the topic of U.S. foreign policy. So I think I think you all made the right choice tonight. So obviously our question for tonight is a little misleading. Capitalism can't really be either moral or immoral because it's not a person. It's a system or it's a tool, and it's run by us, by human beings. So the real question for tonight is whether we're structuring capitalism, whether we're using markets in the right way to create the most moral society that we can, the best society that we can. Are we using the tool properly? And my view is that we're not by a long shot. And in fact, I think we're doing a terrible job of using this tool. As I see it, capitalism, or the version that we have embraced here in America lately, is really undermining all the moral values that we care about, all of us, Republicans and Democrats. Let me just give two examples to get the discussion going, and then we can explore more later. First, today's form of capitalism is undermining the ethics and integrity of Americans. A few years ago, I published a book called The Cheating Culture. Actually, I was just at the Commonwealth Club in April talking about it. And among other things, I try to explain why it is that there's been so much cheating and so much dishonesty and these huge financial frauds in our business sector and on Wall Street, nonstop scandals for years. And what I argue is that there's so much cheating today in business, not because people are less moral in some fundamental way, but rather because of certain aspects of today's form of capitalism. And in particular, high levels of inequality and insecurity, a harsh dog-eat-dog economy, and less regulation. Start with the inequality. Cheating simply makes more sense when the winners are getting these huge rewards and everybody else is just trying to keep their heads above water. So, you look at business. CEOs today make fortunes that executives of a generation ago could never have dreamed of and frankly would have been ashamed to ask for. Hedge fund managers, the top hedge fund managers today are making, some of them, several billion dollars a year. We live in a winner-take-all society in which the top 1% makes more money than the bottom 100 million people put together. And, given these, how big these rewards have become in this new gilded age, it shouldn't be so surprising that more people will cheat and lie and hurt others in order to get those rewards. Inequality has been talked about a lot lately. My angle is inequality may be many things. It is certainly bad for our ethics and bad for morality. You can see this logic in the recent real estate meltdown. These Wall Street investment firms, they had huge incentives to buy and sell mortgage debt in ways that were downright criminal. Some of these executives, they made hundreds of millions of dollars pushing this toxic stuff onto investors around the world. You know, there's been a tendency to demonize the executives in these Wall Street people who orchestrated these scandals and frauds. I don't think these people are evil. I don't think they're that much different from anybody else. For the most part, they're ordinary people who are exposed to extraordinary temptation. George Washington once said, "Few men have virtue enough to withstand the highest bidder." And lately, the bidding in this era of inequality, the bidding for our integrity, our morality, has been getting higher and higher and higher. Meanwhile, as I also document in my book, a great many people cheat just because they're trying to survive in today's increasingly harsh economic climate, which is another aspect of contemporary capitalism, high levels of insecurity. So think of those mortgage brokers, the lower level people who we read about who were pushing these subprime loans on some of the poorest people in America. You know, well, why would you try to get some African-American 80-year-old grandmother into an 11% interest rate when she has credit enough to good enough credit to get a 6% loan? Because you want to pay your mortgage and keep your head above water. That's the kind of economic system that we've somehow found ourselves in. You know, many people might say that, well, it's not capitalism that has made us immoral. American morals writ large have just gone down the tubes. That is not true. The morality of this country has not declined writ large. Street crime is way down. We have some of the lowest levels of crime the FBI has ever recorded in this country. Drunk driving deaths are down. Divorce is down. Smoking is down. Teen pregnancy is at the lowest rate since 1946. All sorts of moral indicators have been moving in the right direction. But our ethics around money and around business have been in decline, and we can blame our capitalist system, the one we have, for that. Not to mention how all these wealthy interests have been putting to sleep the watchdogs that are supposed to be enforcing the rules and keeping us moral. I have a lot of other examples to talk about. I would like to mention how capitalism is affecting the family, how it's affecting our work ethic, how it's affecting responsibility and whether people who are caught doing bad things are punished. In area after area, the system we have is hurting our morals. And, you know, it doesn't have to be this way. This is a tool, as I said. It's one that we control. We can make different choices. And it's precisely because it is a tool that doesn't have its own soul, that doesn't have its own moral systems, its own moral compass, that we can't let the market set the rules for our society and our morality. We need to set the rules for the market. And that means an active role for government, which is our way collectively to set rules and to ensure that our human values are reflected in our economic system, not destroyed by them.
It's time now to continue our discussion with Dr. Yarnbrook and Dr. David Callahan. I want to encourage you to ask each other questions also if you would like to. Yarn, you started off with a definition of morality. I looked it up in preparation. So morality is virtuous conduct. But what is virtuous conduct? It's virtuousness by definition of the culture of the person who defines what virtuousness is, I suppose.
Well, there needs to be a standard. I mean, the problem with that definition is you're right. It's kind of a dead end.
Right.
I would argue that it's virtuous conduct with the aim, the goal, of furthering one's own life. It Rand defines it as, you know, a system of values by which we make important decisions in our life. It's how we choose between right and wrong. Now, where does that come from? Where do those virtues come from? I don't think they come from culture. That's meaningless to say they come from culture, because whose culture? Where is it? I don't think they come from up above. I think they have to be figured out. I think morality, ethics, is a science. We have to figure out what works in furthering the life of a human being and what doesn't work. And I think it's quite clear what works and what doesn't work. Therefore, it's quite clear what should be the virtues and what should be vices.
So what would you say are critical components of a virtuous person?
So in my view, the most critical component is reason. Is the use of one's mind, is living one's life based on rational thought. If we look at all the values human beings have created from the beginning of time, all the values that we have around us, all the material stuff, but not just material stuff, all the spiritual values, they are all products of human reason. They're all products of the human mind. So if you want to live a good life, if you want to have an important life, to me, the most important virtue is thinking. It's reasoning. And I think everything else is kind of a consequence of that, whether honesty just means being true to the facts. Because you know what? If you're going to be rational, you better have facts. Otherwise, you know, what's it in computers? Garbage in, garbage out. So you want to make sure that what comes in is good, which is what honesty is. You want to have integrity. You want to live by your principles. You want to have justice. You want to treat people the way they deserve. So it's all an application of this rational idea to various aspects of your life, to various aspects of your need to deal with reality.
So love is not on your list.
Love is important. It's vital, right? But love is not a moral virtue. Love is a response. It's an emotion. It's a response to somebody else. Love is what you live for, these emotions like love and happiness and joy. Mm-hmm. These are emotions that you live for. So love is it's part of the purpose of life. Mm-hmm. But it's not the virtue. It's not the activity you engage in. The activity you engage in to earn somebody else's love and to earn the ability to love somebody else. The virtues you engage in are things like rationality, integrity, justice, being productive, taking care of yourself. I mean, what could be more important than the knowledge, your own knowledge in yourself, but also in among your fellow men, right? That you can actually take care of yourself, that you can produce, that you can create stuff, that you can make a living for yourself and the people that you do love.
So, David, you would probably have a different list there of what are the critical components of a virtue.
I would not put reason at the top of the virtue list, and I think that reason is a tool that we can use to advance certain aims. I mean, go back to the example of the subprime mortgage broker. Okay, totally rational and reasonable for that person to try to get people on higher interest loans. The bigger, the higher interest loan you'd get somebody in, the bigger your bonus. So they were, a lot of the people who were involved in these financial scandals and who have behaved in such abysmal ways and have done so much harm to other people were behaving rationally and using reason within the system we have.
I would argue they weren't. They weren't being rational. They weren't using reason. Most of them out of jobs
the system,
today.
Well, the system, you're on, the system may not be rational, which is a big part of my point.
And I agree, but the system's not right.
But the people within it were responding to the incentives that were out there.
It's not always rational to respond to your incentives. People who resisted those incentives and practiced better financial management and did better are actually still around today. They've actually grown because they've been able to take over a big market share. And through the market have actually been more successful than the people who couldn't resist that emotion. Being rational doesn't mean doing whatever the incentive happens to be. But look, one thing we agree upon is the system as it is today is screwed up. There is no capitalism today, in my view, in David's view, there's a lot of capitalism. The system's broken. The incentives that were created because government intervention created disastrous incentives in the financial markets that led to horrible behavior. There's no question about that.
We'll come back to the financial crisis, I'm sure. But so just to go back to this question of morality and you know how Yaron and I think about morality, we've had a number of these debates before. And in his moral system, the sort of the individual and their desires seem to be front and center. And I recognize that is important, you know, that doing what we want and living the life we want is extremely important value. But I think most of us would agree that doing for others is extremely important as well, and perhaps more important in many cases, that mutual obligation to other people, to our family members, to people in our communities, to our people who work for us, that this is essential. In fact, probably if you polled the majority of Americans and asked them to describe morality, it would have something to do with acting selflessly, to showing compassion and kindness for others. And I think that this is it's not just an impulse that most of us have to have empathy, but I think it's a basic thing you need for a productive and workable society, that without cooperation, without empathy, without community, you have a very scary kind of society. And, you know, Yaron's idea that, well, it will all sort of work its way out with maximum freedom and pursuit of self-interest will produce the most moral society, I think, has been contradicted by our own history with our social Darwinistic past of, you know, the robber baron era. And I think it's being contradicted in other countries with harsher economic systems than we have right now.
Let me just pick up on one point that you both made. So what is the role of a community, or is there a role for a community, and what is that in both of your kind of, I suppose, in an ideal world?
I think the community is whatever the members of the community voluntarily choose to make of it. So I make a distinction between government, which is an instrument of force, which is an instrument of compulsion, and which we, getting together, decide to do together. And freedom allows us to do whatever we want to do together. But this notion that corporation is built on selflessness is the opposite of the truth. Corporation is built on self-interest. Corporation is built on mutually agreeing to pursue a particular goal together so that both parties benefit from it. I don't want other people sacrificing for me so we can go get something, and I don't want to sacrifice for other people. This is about trade. It's about win-win relationships. And in my view, the appropriate way in which to deal with other people is through trade. And a community is one in which we trade values, and values not just the material, but spiritual values. I think love at the end of the day in a relationship is a form of is a trade. We're trading constantly on values that lead to a mutually beneficial outcome.
So a public good is one that everyone agrees to support.
Well, I don't believe there is such a thing as a public. I'm not sure what a public good is, right? So we might decide, for example, there's a community that came together around the Commonwealth Club because they view it really important to have a debate, to have discussions, to raise the intellectual level within the community. It's voluntary. Some people join, but there are lots of people out there who don't care. And they don't get to join. And they don't join. And nobody's forcing them to join. That's fine. So we've created a community here that's about a particular thing. And the common goal, right, or the good, is debate, intellectual debate. We've voluntarily chosen it. Other communities might form around other goals.
Well, Yaron, the traditional example is when people in a community have livestock and they create an area where they share grazing so that one person's livestock doesn't eat the grass of the other.
And that's a wonderful example, but the American tradition has been that we divvy up that property into private property and then we contract to figure out how we graze across each other's property. So in my view of capitalism, my vision of capitalism, there is no commons. Everything is privately owned, and then we contract. And people are very benevolent, and it's not that hard to do. We contract to use each other's property for a common good, but one which we agree on voluntarily, in which those who don't want to participate don't have to. It's voluntary and it's contractual. The problem with the communal grazing ground
right.
is what if one of the farmers doesn't want to participate? If he has property rights over it, they're trampled on because the majority has decided that we don't care about his property rights. We're just going to use it. I'm against that. I'm for people being able to do with their lives as they're pleased, not what the community decides they should do.
David, what about community for you?
Yeah, I mean, I think that you got to strike a balance in all of this stuff. I mean, the pursuit of self-interest, and I think produces a lot of good stuff in our society. And there's a lot of ways in which capitalism and that profit incentive fosters virtue in a system where you know that there's intense levels of economic competition, where you have to work in order to survive. It forces you to get up in the morning and have a work ethic and to, you know, do the things you're supposed to do and to be a productive person. All that is good, and capitalism produces a tremendous amount of wealth and prosperity, as Yaron mentioned. But so it's a great tool in many ways. But we can't let it run everything. And this is Yaron's vision, that it runs everything, that there is that there are no public schools, there is no public infrastructure, there is no social safety net. I mean, this is what he wants.
I'm not denying it.
And you know, the thing is we don't have to engage in some crazy thought experiment to imagine how this would work out, because we have actually lived some approximation of that in this country, and not too long ago. So if you look back to the year 1959, before we had Medicare, before Social Security was anything more than the most bare-bones system, just look at old people. 25% of all old people lived in poverty in this country. That is what happens when you just leave it up to the market. So in my mind, this is that we want a community that where people engage in selfless behavior to help others who can't help themselves when the market fails. We don't want government to do everything, but we can't leave the market to do everything, that's for sure.
Okay. In both of your books, you call for a fairly informed and knowledgeable public to make these decisions, to engage in community or in the activities. So can you talk about I have to admit that I somewhat bemoan the lack of knowledge and awareness in this country. So what kind of knowledge and awareness do you need to have, and how do you get it? Who's responsible for getting it? And in your case, I think I know the answer. We'll answer first, and then I'll. David keeps telling you what you think. I'm gonna.
Is David gonna start?
David, you start. What is the optimal amount of knowledge and awareness you need, and how do you get it?
More would be better. I don't know whether it's true that the more Americans can identify the Three Stooges than the three branches of government, but if it's true, that's bad. And actually, I think this is a perfect illustration of my point. When you leave important functions of society up to the market, because in the United States today, we basically said, let's let free enterprise handle that whole business of ensuring that the citizens are informed in our democracy and have the information they need to make choices. So we have, our press is more private than any media in the industrialized world. We don't have anything comparable to BBC or other sorts of public systems. And as a result, you turn on the news and it's either toxic shouting talking heads, or it's if it bleeds it leads, or it's Paris Hilton and rich people and celebrities 24/7. That's a perfect example of what happens when you just say, the market can solve the problem. And I've said nothing of our campaign finance system.
So Greek public television did a lot to help them out, deal with the reality that they faced, as has most of Europe. So I wouldn't exchange us with Europe in terms of knowledge of what works and what doesn't any day. But look, yeah, people are ignorant. They're ignorant exactly for the opposite reason David just articulated. It's because our mechanisms for conveying knowledge are all controlled by the government. And the prime here is public education. So let me just quickly answer your question. Who's responsible?
Yeah.
The individual is responsible. Each individual is responsible for the knowledge they have. But who's conveying that knowledge today? What's the expectation today? The expectation is you go to school and you learn something. Well, the fact is you go to school and you don't learn stuff. You don't learn how to read, write, and math, the basic stuff that makes all other knowledge possible. Our public educational system is a disaster. It is pathetic. It is run by government. It is run by exactly the entity that David would like to run our television stations and our educational programs on TV. I mean, the thought is scary. Even our universities today are incredibly corrupted by the involvement of government. Almost all students today attend university, through basically loans, which I think many of them don't think they'll ever have to pay back, provided by government. The government is involved in a lot of the decisions that happen at the university level today. Our educational system is a government system, so we can see how well it functions. We've got an experiment right there and there. The more government gets involved in these activities, and this is true economically, this is true in education, this is true everywhere, the more corrupt, the more corruption you actually get. It's no accident that the cheating that David describes happens in regulated industries and doesn't happen in unregulated industries. So here in Silicon Valley, which is the least regulated industry in the United States, there's very little cheating that goes on. In the financial world, the most regulated industry in the U.S., there's a lot of cheating that goes on. And you remember Enron, WorldCom, and those guys? You remember what industry they were part of? All of them. In the late 90s, all of them, all these corrupt guys were in the same industry, in the telecommunications industry, that had just gone through what we call deregulation, but it's actually re-regulation, changing the rules. So they all became in bed with politicians to try to get the rules in their favor versus somebody else. There's no free market in these industries, and therefore there's more corruption. Let me just make a point about public education. Yeah, I'd like to abolish it. This is an awful, corrupt, unmanageable system. I'd like, you know how we have a lot of brain power going into figuring out how to make this slightly better? I mean, will anybody's life be worse off if we don't make this slightly better? How much brain power do we have in trying to make education better? None. Because there's no profit motive. There's no incentive. Wouldn't you like to see Steve Jobs, the Steve Jobses of the educational world? Wouldn't you like to see the competition, the innovation, the Silicon Valley, that kind of brain power motivated by the profit motive, driven into an educational programs, private schools that are motivated by providing the best product possible to their customers, not to the unions, but to their customers, the parents. I mean, what could be more important today in America than getting rid of public education and privatizing it so we could actually get a great product that we could be proud of, that we could be happy to send our kids to school every morning?
Before I take that up, I want to say that you're listening to the Commonwealth Club of California. Our speakers tonight are Dr. Yaron Brook, Executive Director of the Ayn Rand Institute, and Dr. David Callahan, co-founder of the think tank Demos, and who are debating the issue of, is capitalism moral? So, Yaron, is in world history, what period of time and place is the most reflective of what you'd like to see?
Well, no period of time accurately reflects it, because each period of time, A, had much more government intervention than I would like to see. And clearly a cultural philosophy that a morality that wasn't what I would like to see, because Ayn Rand, you know, died relatively recently. But, you know, in terms of political freedom, 19th century America, particularly after the Civil War, given that before that we had slavery, which is, I think we all agree, was a really bad thing.
Right.
But in the 20th century, I would say, you know, the Hong Kong of the 50s, 70s, 80s, even today, pretty good thing. You know, Hong Kong was this fishing village 100 years ago with nothing there, no natural resources, nothing. And people risked their lives to get there from all over Asia. And Hong Kong has really no significant safety net. None of the redistribution of policies we have today. Basically protection of property rights, and that's it. And per capita GDP there is equal today to the United States, partially because we've kind of stagnated as they've increased. So it's those eras, and I'm sure David has all the horror stories of the 19th century, which I'd be happy to answer one after the other, in terms of why they were nowhere near as horrible as he claims, and some of them were actually virtues. But I think that's when we came. By the way, I would take a 19th century American population qua education over today's products of the public schools.
So I lived in Hong Kong for a number of years, and one of the reasons that the average per capita income is high is because there is extremely wealthy people there, as well as quite poor people. So in your worldview, there are winners and losers.
No.
No?
No. I mean, I don't consider being poor in Hong Kong a loser, and I don't think the poor in Hong Kong consider themselves losers. So I think in my world, they're winners and winners. Some people make more money than others. I don't consider life about money. You can be poor and incredibly happy. You can be rich and incredibly miserable. Mm-hmm. Life is about happiness. And, you know, how successful you are in living your life, not in accumulating dollars. That's the measure of success. And the fact is, you know, I chose a PhD in finance. I could have gone to work in Wall Street. I chose to teach because I enjoy that more. I'm going to be happier teaching than I am going to be making lots of money on Wall Street. That's not the standard. But in a free society, people get to decide, at least to some extent, how much effort they want to put into making money versus other things. People get to be the best that they can be within the framework. But people also know in such a society that whatever it is that they make, a lot of money, a little bit of money, they made it. That is, they can take pride in it. They're not living off of other people. They're not, you know, I believe that the biggest victims today in America of redistributive policies are the poor, because I think we institutionalize them into poverty. We destroy their ability to have self-esteem because they haven't worked. Minimum wage is a policy that destroys the ability of inner-city youths to find a job. And as a consequence, they will never gain the self-esteem that we all have because we've worked for a living, because we've taken care of ourselves and our families and the people we love. We get our self-esteem from work. When you deny people work by so-called helping them, what you're doing is you're destroying the capacity to live a fulfilling, happy life.
David.
Just to take up that subject of work, because it's a subject I treated in a chapter in my book, The Moral Center. And one of the point I make about work is one of these great American values. Everybody across the political spectrum says that they believe in work. And I certainly do. But this is a virtue, I think, that's being undermined by our current economic system, because we have a low-wage economy in this society where millions of people, tens of millions of people, are not making a living wage. They're working full-time. They're not making enough money. Why aren't they making enough money? Because it's profitable for corporations not to pay them a living wage. That companies cannot pay, you know, pay what the going rate is, and it's often below what people need to actually survive. So here we have a country that believes completely in work, and we have tens of millions of people who are working full-time. You know, a quarter of all people in this country make under $20,000 a year who work full-time. That's not enough money. And you can't say that you believe in work and think that that's okay. And 50% of those of the labor force does not have any kind of employer-provided pension system. A third do not have any sort of employer-provided health insurance. I mean, this is not okay.
There are questions to you here about is it all right to make a lot of money? Is it all right to invent something that changes the world?
Oh, absolutely. I think that I have no problem with people making a lot of money. The problem I have is when they're making when their huge fortune is dependent upon exploitation of others. And I would cite the Walton family as an example. The Walton family, one family in America, has a combined net worth of $90 billion, which is more than the bottom 40% of all Americans put together. How did the Walton family, which built the Walmart, you know, retail empire, how did they make all that money? Well, they made all that money in part by paying extremely low wages, which, by the way, are only possible for them to pay in many cases because we have the earned income tax credit, we have SCHIP, and we have other government subsidies that allow Walmart workers to actually survive. A lot of these Walmart workers, the only reason they survive is because they're taking advantage of these government subsidies that are designed for low-income workers. I don't think that's okay. In my mind, that's not a moral society. That's something more akin to a dystopian society.
Yes, I have
society.
A comment on Walmart.
So I would love to get rid of SCHIP and get rid of the earned income tax credit. But let me say this. No company, no family in human history has done more to help the standard of living of poor people than has Walmart. Walmart has made it possible for poor consumers in this country to buy products at unthinkable values. Walmart has created these win-win situations across the board. And to the extent that government regulations have created perversions of income across America, there's no question about that. Let's get rid of those government interventions so people actually get a wage that they negotiate rather than a wage that's influenced by all kind of government government schemes. Well, of all people, I mean, who shops at Walmart? Whose standard of living has gone up because of Walmart? The poor.
Okay, so Walmart brings me to another set of questions, which is about globalization. In fact, the great majority of products that are made for Walmart are made in China, and increasingly Vietnam and other Bangladesh. So they're able to sell at a lower price because they're paying lower wages in another part of the world. So I want to just talk about your visions of how does globalization impact on your vision, and because that is probably not going anywhere. We are increasingly interconnected economies around the world. So, David.
Oh, well, I think globalization has been a dual-edged sword, as are a lot of aspects of capitalism. So on the one hand, globalization has produced this tremendous increase in living standards for hundreds of millions of people around the world. I mean, hundreds of millions of people in China, in India, and other countries have emerged from deep poverty because of globalization and because of getting jobs, selling products to other countries like ours. On the other hand, the effect on workers here has been really alarming and distressing because it has basically undercut the ability of workers to not only have the good middle class manufacturing jobs with benefits often gone overseas, but it's depressed, globalization has helped depress wages for all workers and create a tremendous level of insecurity. And so I see it as really feeding this capitalist system that is not really in tune with the moral values that Americans care about.
Mm-hmm.
So I believe in trade. I believe in any kind of trade, you know, among consulting adults. And borders shouldn't matter. That is, it doesn't matter to me whether what I'm buying or who I'm trading lives across the street or lives across the state line or lives across a national line. The more trading, the more mutually beneficial transactions happen, everybody benefits. A trade is, by definition, we enter into a trade with the intent to gain. It's a win-win transaction. So if I'm trading with Chinese, I'm winning, and the Chinese are winning. Now, yes, this openness, opening up the borders, and I wish there was more of it. I would lower tariffs to zero in the United States. I think this is a good thing. But at the same time, yes, our workers, many workers in America, who are incredibly productive, are at a disadvantage. And they're at a disadvantage because of the massive government regulations that make hiring Americans so expensive. Not to mention our immigration policies, which is a particularly sensitive issue here in Silicon Valley, where there's a huge, huge shortage of engineers, massive, tens of thousands, if not hundreds of thousands of engineers that could find a job here, don't, because we don't allow them in, and we don't produce them because our public education system is so rotten. But if we deregulated, if we allowed true labor markets to emerge, I think we would lose fewer jobs would be lost in this country, more people would be employed. We'd specialize. I mean, look, the idea of how international trade works goes down back to Adam Smith, who was fighting against mercantilism back in the 18th century. No economist, including, by the way, Paul Krugman, who won his Nobel Prize in Economics on an essay about free trade that he wrote decades ago. He's forgotten that essay since, but he did write it. He used to know economics once. Free trade is mutually beneficial, and we should encourage it, but we should also encourage a massive deregulation, getting the government out of the business between employees and employers.
Okay, so let me just ask you, back to the China question, because I know a lot about that. And we all know that Chinese food products can be tainted, and especially things like baby formula. And you talk about between two consenting adults. Is there a role for government to make sure that you don't buy poisonous baby formula?
Oh, sure, if it's poisonous, absolutely. There are laws against selling poison as something else. We call that fraud. But more than that, look, We live in a society in which companies just rely on government to give an FDA stamp of approval on drugs, on food, and everything. We don't have a robust safety mechanism that that markets would evolve. Would evolve a much better system than the FDA has today. There would, if Safeway was liable for the food that they were selling from China, and liable means a court system, means a government. If they were liable for the food, do you think they would sell rotten food at Safeway? No. Safeway would invest heavily in supervising, in, certification, in making sure that food was healthy. Indeed, I believe that the products that we bring from China, the food that we eat, would be safer if we got rid of the FDA than with a bunch of bureaucrats who make very low wages, who have no profit incentive to do a good job supervising the quality of our food and of the products we import.
David, do you have something to say about that, or should we move on?
I think the FDA is good. But I know we're almost out of time.
I just need to say you're listening to the Commonwealth Club of California radio program. Our speakers tonight are Dr. Yaron Brook, Executive Director of the Ayn Rand Institute, and Dr. David Callahan, co-founder of the think tank Demos, who are debating the issue, is capitalism moral? There's quite a few questions about how we should think about taxes and what the value of taxes is and how to figure out. I think it must be because we're right in the middle of an election season. So, David, do you have views about the utility and the structure of taxes?
Let me just say, the position I take about taxes is that I don't think that anybody could make any money if there weren't an organized society. If we didn't have roads, if we didn't have laws, if we didn't have all the things that we together as a community, have developed to make prosperity possible, nobody would make any money. Businesses would not succeed. And therefore, the wealth that you make in a business or as an individual is not yours, per se. It belongs to all of us. And I think that we together make the decision in terms of how much of that wealth you get to keep. I do not take the view that if you make money, you've made it in some state of nature, it's all yours, and then it's like government is trying to get it. I take the opposite view. And so in terms of my meta starting point. And then in terms of our tax system, there's a lot that we could say about this. As a general rule, I would like a tax system that taxed bad things like pollution and consumption, not good things like wealth and wealth creation. And so I would like to see more fundamental kinds of tax reform than anything that's being discussed. We should have taxes on pollution, taxes on carbon, taxes on overconsumption, through a sales tax, progressive sales tax or VAT. That would be the best way to raise money, not taxing people who work for a living and not taxing investors who are taking risks with their capital. I think that there's better ways to raise revenue in a society. And I think that there's ways to get a bipartisan majority to agree to that, actually, in Washington.
You might agree with some of those things.
So, I'll agree with the final part. I certainly think, maybe we can agree on the fact that a consumption tax would be better than any other form tax, get rid of all the taxes and just have a consumption. We'd structure it differently. I would just want a flat consumption tax. You wouldn't want a progressive consumption tax. But that's right. It taxes on investment and so on. But I also happen to think that since I breathe in and out carbon, that it's not a pollutant. Otherwise, I don't consider my breathing pollution. So I don't consider CO2 a pollutant.
Polar bears have a different view.
No, I don't think they do. They breathe out CO2 as well. But let me just point out a more fundamental point, and that is taxes are coercion. I'm against coercion. So to the extent that we're going to have to unwind this massive economy, this massive public sector, we're going to have to tax. Lower is better. Lower, simpler is going to be better than anything we have today. And I agree, you don't want to tax production. You don't want to tax investment. But the principle is I'm against taxes because they're coercive, and I don't believe in coercion. I think violence, I think force, I think forcing people to pay for something they don't want is wrong.
I have two daughters who are 18 and 17. And it is amazing to me that their friends don't want to go to Wall Street, don't want to make a lot of money, but are really committed to making the world a better place. And you may have heard the statistic that 18% of last year's Harvard University graduating class applied for Teach for America. It might be because we're in a recession, but it might not only be because we're in a recession. That there is a sense of, I sense it in, certainly among my children and their friends, that youth are taking a different path. In your work, when you go out and you talk to groups, are you finding that there's generational differences in the reaction to your work? And if so, how do those play out?
Well, I think that the millennial generation coming up is definitely more optimistic and believes more in kind of doing things together. And through, they believe more strongly in government. They believe more, they believe strongly in volunteerism. Mm-hmm. They have a sense that we can do big things together. I think that my generation, Gen X and baby boomers, have a little more or a lot more cynicism. And I think that that in many ways that the legacy of the 60s, we've been living, we sort of came through this age of extreme individualism. You know, on the left was sort of do your own thing in the counterculture, and then the right, this sort of libertarian greed is good, self-interest is virtuous, you know, stuff. And I think I think we're seeing pushback to that, and we're seeing it in these millennial kids.
Yeah.
So I think if the two of you are right, we're in deep, deep trouble. I think it's a horrible trend. It's terrible. But going back to the way you stated what you stated, making the world a better place, what could make the world a better place than inventing new products and helping fund them and facilitate the distribution across the world by, you know, coming up with a Walmart or coming up with an Intel or working on Wall Street to create the IPOs that made those possible? What could make a better place than going out there and creating wealth, not just for yourself, because that's not how wealth is created. I mean, making wealth for yourself is fine, is good, not just fine. But by making wealth for yourself, you're making millions and millions and millions of people better off. Capitalism, the wealth creation system, has done more for poor people, for middle class people, for everybody, than any other system. Philanthropy, you add up all the philanthropy in the world, all the charity in the world, and it hasn't done a fraction of what just a couple of companies here in Silicon Valley have done to make the world a better place. So if you want to make a world a better place, go make lots of money, at least under capitalism. Now, granted, today's system is not capitalism, so a lot of people make the world, you know, make a lot of wealth by exploitation. I reject that. But if you're really doing it through trading, if you're really doing it in a free market, then the making of the money is by its very nature, because you're trading with other people, making the world a better place. And I hope that our brightest, our most ambitious students continue to go into productive professions in which they are making the world a better place by creating lots of wealth.
Well, my older daughter just wants to save the corals.
Don't worry, 18% may have applied for Teach for America, but I'm sure the other 30% applied to Goldman Sachs.
Is there a difference between making products and selling them and making money on Wall Street, in your view?
No, not a proper Wall Street. Now, today Wall Street is all about cronyism. It's all about being in bed with government. But a proper Wall Street, absolutely not. You cannot create products unless you have a financial mechanism, unless you have the financial institutions in order to raise the capital, to distribute the capital, to create the, you know, the mechanism makes that possible. Wall Street has a hard time because they can't hide behind a product, but they are just as vital to the standard of living that we all enjoy as any company that actually makes something. Let me just say the best way to save the corals is to privatize them. and because then there's a private incentive to keep beautiful corals, and you charge people to go scuba diving and see them. And that's how they save the elephants in Africa. And that's how, if you really want to save the corals, you will save the corals.
I think that I think that Wall Street is a good example of how American capitalism has gotten badly perverted, and not because of government regulation. Wall Street is really important. It is a really important function to take all of us, our money as savers and investors, and to aggregate it and to lend it to, or, you know, invest it in companies or help companies raise capital. That's all really important. But Wall Street turned into this sort of mad rush to make profits as an end in itself, and became more of a casino kind of environment. And it was not because of too much regulation, because the trend over 30 years was deregulation and more deregulation, and Wall Street increasingly calling the shots and telling the regulators what rules they wanted and having huge influence in Washington. That is the important story that I think most people are familiar with at this point. And in terms of, because I know we're getting to the to the end here, but in terms of capitalism at large, I mean, I agree with Iran that there's no better system for creating wealth than the free market, and that capitalism has done more for poor people than any other system in the history of the world. It's a fantastic system for wealth creation, and prosperity creates a lot of moral outcomes. Wealthy societies tend to be more tolerant societies, they're more rational societies, they're more peaceful societies, they are societies with bigger safety nets and more compassionate. What I want is not to get rid of capitalism. What I want is to, or get rid of markets. What I want them is to, I just want some more balance than where we are right now. I'm not suggesting, I mean, yanking the needle one way or the other. I'm suggesting to make some modifications so that certain core values that we believe in, like compassion for others, mutual obligation, respecting the value of work, ensuring that everybody's playing on the same playing field, that those values are upheld, and we also get all the prosperity. Basically, I want to get as much of the good stuff as we can from capitalism while also holding on to our core values.
Okay.
I think that we can get this balance.
I have a final question. So you each have one more answer to this question. We are in a campaign season, and in a couple of weeks we'll have made a decision about a president. You both talk about fairly utopian views about the way that you would like the country to go. And they're different utopias, but there are utopian views. Will you just talk about some very specific next steps that we could do to go closer to where you want us to go, to evolve to as a country and as a world? David, do you want to go first?
Yeah, I mean, first of all, I don't think that what I just said is in any way utopian. Mm-hmm. I said I didn't want to jam the dial one way radically or the other. I said mm-hmm. I wanted to make some adjustments. And what I want looks a lot like what some other countries in the advanced industrialized world have. I would like an American version of that, where there's more room for individual dynamism. But I don't think it's utopian. In terms of what I would like to see in this country, one issue, and I would just like to take this opportunity to address Yaron's comments about public education. You know, I have a 5-year-old child, been thinking of moving, looking at public schools. I noticed that all the public schools in rich communities are, and many times, great. A lot of these public schools are fantastic. Parents love them. Students are doing extremely well. The schools in rich communities are often extremely good schools. The terrible schools we're all hearing about tend to be schools in poor communities. That reflects the massive inequities in our society, which are a product of the form of capitalism, largely unregulated, that we have today. This is one thing I think we need to address in this country if we're going to have any shot at economic inequality, which is to not have public education the critical starting point for people to be determined by what zip code they live in and how wealthy the community is. And so I would like to see, neither president's really talked much about that, lots of other things I'd like to see. I'd certainly like to see climate change on the agenda. I don't think that we should let the profit motive and our current form of capitalism determine how much greenhouse gases are emitted and whether our grandchildren have a sustainable earth. That's not morally right to me.
Okay, thank you. All right. Next step.
If you think that public schools in rich neighborhoods are good, you don't know what good is. And that's the point, partially, is we don't know what good is. But education could be so much better that even the best public schools can offer us. But we won't discover it until we actually have real competition and real innovation in the marketplace to create it. What I'd like to see, you know, is a dramatic reduction in the size of government, a dramatic reduction in the scope of what government does. You know, and I think if the Republicans were just a little smart, what they would do. No, I mean, it's a problem. They're not. And they're not politically smart, and it really is a challenge. But, you know, what they would do is they would run in a campaign right now, and they would do this once they got into office, cut all subsidies to business. That's a winning slogan, and it's something that can be done, including farm subsidies. It would cut between $300 billion to $500 billion off the budget right off the bat. They're concerned. Instead of being portrayed as the nasty party that just wants to cut for the poor, start with business. Cut it all. Take away all the tax incentives. Have, you know, lower the corporate tax rate, ideally to zero, but, you know, because consumers are the ones who actually pay corporate taxes. But lower the corporate taxes, flatten it, and just get rid of all the tax subsidies, but all the other subsidies, get rid of them all, and start shrinking government. And then the big thing that you have to do, whether we say it up here or don't say it, and whether the politicians in Washington want to acknowledge it or not, they're going to have to deal with entitlements. Now, I would like to see us have a plan for phasing them out over the next two generations or one generation, but they're going to have to deal with these because they are driving us bankrupt. We will go bankrupt if we don't deal with them quickly and drastically soon. And just to end on education, if there's one issue which is probably the most important for the future of this country, it is education. As long as government controls education and the educational product, we will not be completely free. So if you want to fight for one thing, you know, maybe it's far-reaching. I wouldn't call it utopian. Then let's fight for private education to privatize American schools.
Okay. Thank you to our panelists, Dr. Yoram Brook, Executive Director of the Ayn Rand Institute and author of Free Market Revolution, How Ayn Rand's Ideas Can End Big Government, and to Dr. David Callahan, co-founder of the think tank Demos and author of The Moral Center, How Progressives Can Unite America Around Our Shared Values. We also want to thank our audience here and on the radio, television, and the Internet. This program has been part of the Commonwealth Club's American Value Series, underwritten by the Corrett and Taube Family Foundations. We also want to remind everyone that copies of Dr. Brooks and Dr. Callahan's books are on sale out in the lobby, and they will be pleased to sign them immediately following this program. I'm Dr. Ruth Shapiro, and now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, the place where you're in the know, is adjourned.